On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk Apple services and they're becoming more valuable each and every day. Why do we trust them so much? Also, why do we trust security firms so much with our data? Reminds me of the Gatekeeper software. And of course, another great guest, we talk a little bit about hybrid clouds. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 252, recorded August 11th, 2017. Trusting your hybrid cloud.
This episode of Twyatt is brought to you by Cloudflare. More than 6 million websites, apps, APIs, and SaaS companies use Cloudflare services to weather whatever the internet throws at them. For a free online chat session with a Cloudflare support engineer, visit cloudflare.com/twit. And by Amazon Kinesis from AWS, a powerful new way to easily collect, process, and analyze streaming data so you can get timely insights and react quickly to new information. Learn more at kinesis.aws.
Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host for today, Louis Maresca, your guide through the world of the enterprise. But this world is pretty big, and the enterprise is pretty big, and I need another co-host in crime to help me with the whole world, and that's Mr. Brian Chee, the director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chee-Bert, I heard you had some sensor camp goodness this past week.
Yes, we actually had 18 ancient Hawaiian fish pond people all getting together at Pai Pai Ohe'ia. It's a 88-acre Hawaiian fish pond, and we were talking about, we all built ultrasonic water level sensors and started teaching them about how to use single board computers like Raspberry Pis so we can do things like pH measurement, salinity, all kinds of other good stuff. And the whole idea is we're trying to use science to help us figure out how the ancient Hawaiians were so darn efficient at using fish pond, you know, aquaculture, to feed a fairly large population for the amount of land they were using.
So cool. So cool. You guys get to play with all the toys. That's so much fun. Cool. Well, folks, we have a pretty good show today. We're talking a little bit about Apple services and how they're becoming more valuable every day. We want to know why and what's the take on it? What's going on? Also, we want to talk a little bit about security firms and why we trust them so much. And of course, we also have a great guest to talk a little bit about the hybrid cloud. But first, let's get into the blips. What would you or a small business do if your data just kind of disappeared from your cloud service? I would say this is a true sysadmin's nightmare. A simple configuration change could take down a service or even accidentally lose data. Well, this past week, Cisco's Meraki service had such a blip. What happened? Well, the engineering team made a configuration change that applied an erroneous policy to North American object storage service and caused a data upload prior to 11:20 a.m. Pacific time on August 3rd to delete data. The kind of data deleted ranged from custom floor plans, logos, enterprise apps, voicemail greetings found on user dashboards, system manager of devices and phone caches. But how much data is still in question. We don't actually know how much data was deleted, but Cisco is still trying to actually recover partial of the data from their caches. This might cause a bit of a hit on the service since Meraki is sold on the basis that its cloud service removes much of the grunt work required to run networks and voice systems. This blip due to the configuration changes is in the wake of the actual big Amazon S3 outage that happened back in March. What have we learned here? DevOps is not easy. Which wise, there's so many startups and corporations trying to solve this problem.
You know, what is the FCC smoking? I mean, really, Americans don't want fast internet? Yeah. So, I quote, Americans might not need fast home internet connection, the Federal Communications Commission suggests in a new document. Instead, mobile internet via a smartphone might be all people need. The suggestion comes in the FCC's annual inquiry into broadband availability. Section 706 of the Telecommunications Act requires the FCC to determine whether broadband, or more formally, advanced telecommunications capability, is being deployed to all Americans in a reasonable and timely fashion. If the SEC finds that broadband isn't being deployed quickly enough to everyone, it is required by law to, quote, take immediate action to accelerate deployment of such capability by removing barriers to infrastructure investment and by promoting competition in the telecommunications market. Yeah. My question is, why does the FCC and Ajit Pai think we don't actually want both? We've already seen some really interesting things happen when mobile speeds up, and we've seen some really interesting things happen from faster home internet and Google Fiber. So is this Ajit Pai's crystal ball, or is the FCC trying to make something specific happen?
If you wanted to leak data off a router silently and actually without detection, all you'd have to do is use the blinking status lights on it. Researchers from the Bulgarian University of Negev Cybersecurity Research Center were able to do exactly that. By compromising the firmware of the router via malware called XLED, the researchers were able to exfiltrate data on a TP-Link router. According to the paper abstract, data from the router could be leaked at rates of 10 bits per second to more than 1 kilobit per second per each LED. This was essentially flashing the LEDs at more than 1,000 flicks per second for each light. This is an interesting way to secretly siphon data from a router, but I'm a strong believer that if you have compromised and a rooted device already taken over at the firmware level, you probably have more problems waiting for you than just 1 kilobyte of data siphoning out. Just saying.
So I guess our friends at the FAA, not the FCC, but the FAA is actually pretty worried about GPS getting hacked. The gist of this story is that the GPS signals are actually relatively weak because they're coming from orbit, and the bad guys could potentially broadcast a stronger version and throw off GPS navigation. This is not a James Bond plot. So back in the pre-GPS days, we would fly, and I say we because I used to do this, with two navigation radios, one pointing forward, the other pointing backwards, and we'd keep them needles lined up. What the FAA is talking about is bringing back radio navigation beacons as a backup plan. The Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, told the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence in May, the global threat of electronic warfare attacks against space systems will expand into the coming years in both number and types of weapons. Development may very likely focus on jamming capabilities against dedicated military satellite communications, aka SATCOM, synthetic aperture radar, SAR, imaging satellites, and enhanced capabilities against global navigation satellite systems, GNSS, such as the U.S. Global Positioning System. Gee, I guess some of those old skills for this old codger is going to come back into being handy again.
Well, who do you think will perfect the self-driving car first? Well, the race is on, and the companies like Google, Volvo, and now Intel are in it to win it. For Intel, it started this year with an announcement that it's buying Israeli company Mobileye for $15.3 billion. Mobileye systems used by 27 car makers depend on its specialized cameras to sense cars' surroundings on the road. Its tech is actually behind the emergency braking and lane systems that are becoming more common in new vehicles. The acquisition was no surprise since the two companies were working already together with BMW on autonomous vehicles. Well, they're back in the news again with a claim that they're building a fleet of over 100 test vehicles with SAE Level 4 capability, which means that's full self-driving capabilities, with the first of those hitting the roads later this year. It's their way of not only showing off Intel's Mobileye hybrid autonomous driving software system, but it's also a way for them to sell a bit of system.
Well, isn't that special? Well, the U.S. Army is banning the use of all DJI products for the foreseeable future. The reason may be related to information gathering by DJI's products that could include geographic location of flights, audio, and video. Translated, the Army is worried that DJI drones are phoning home with location and video, and with those concerns stemming from consumer complaints about privacy concerns about the DJI Go app, to which DJI has answered. Since we cannot access it, we cannot provide it to anyone else, even with a court order or another valid legal demand. DJI maintains the system transmits location information so that DJI users can comply with the FAA no-fly zones. Intentional collection by DJI is likely not the issue found by Army Research Labs, however. The problem may be related to others gaining access to telemetry data in the field, including adversaries. The Islamic State has used DJI drones heavily in Iraq and Syria, even rigging them to drop grenades on their enemies. Since the drones are so ubiquitous and the control protocols are well known, ARL may have found that an adversary could hijack a control session through a bug in DJI's protocol or obtain telemetry, audio, and video covertly. What this means for the world's most popular drone has yet to be seen. But is this a concern for other mainland Chinese products like those from Huawei or others?
In this day and age, privacy is a commodity. If anyone knows, it's Valerie Plame. Why? Well, back in 2003, the Washington Post ousted Valerie as a CIA covert operative. Not only was this a shock to her and her family, it also turned her life upside down. What Valerie wanted most in her life? Well, she wanted her privacy back. As Plame puts it, there are two sides to privacy. The corporate side, selling you stuff, and the government area where the NSA doing next level stuff, which has spilled over into privacy. As she puts it, the government has a ton of information on Americans, and Americans seem to be okay with it. But historically, the government doesn't seem to be carefully handling that data. As she points out, people want to protect their online accounts, but they don't want to jump through hoops to do it. Start by actually creating harder passwords. You have a 15 characters, use it. If you have multi-factor auth, use it. You can encrypt your data with secondary password, biometrics, use it. Anything to add the layer approach to security. For hackers and invaders alike, it's a fun puzzle for them to go through each one of the layers, but sooner or later, they give up. For her, security and privacy is everything, and it's time everyone starts to take it more seriously. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. But next up, we get into the bites, where we talk a little bit about your health data and why we trust security firms so much. But first, we want to thank our sponsors of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And, of course, Leo wants to tell you about them. Thanks, Leo.
Hey, we'll have more with This Week in Enterprise Tech in a moment. But first, I want to tell all you enterprise guys and gals about something you already know, I'm sure, Cloudflare. Now, you're going to say, oh, yeah, Cloudflare. They do, and then X, which is probably they're best known, I think, for DDoS protection, right? If you sign up with Cloudflare and you get hit, now it could be by a bad guy who's trying to bring your site down with a lot of traffic, or it could just be good. It could be like you were featured on Twitter or something and you get a huge amount of traffic. No matter what, they ramp up the bandwidth to handle it. So that is a great thing, but it's not the only thing Cloudflare does. They're also what's called a CDN, a content distribution network. You know about those. They have 115-plus data centers all over the world. So that moves your content closer to your visitors so it loads faster. It's a huge improvement. In fact, everything they do helps speed up the web. They also support, if you're on mobile, IPv6. That makes, you know, a significant, like, two-figure percentage improvement, double percentage point improvement in your performance on mobile. And I can go on and on. They also are the best web application firewall in the world. And I'll tell you why. They use crowdsourcing so that when there is a threat on the internet, they know about it before anybody else, and they protect you and your site and your app and your SaaS application from it, which is amazing. It's amazing. One of the ways they can do that, one of the things that makes them the best, is they have a free tier. And I think anybody listening who wants to try Cloudflare should absolutely sign up your personal site, say, for the free Cloudflare. You get all those benefits, but you're contributing to the internet firewall, because when you see dubious traffic or so forth, it automatically, you know, it goes through Cloudflare. They get a heads up and they can protect everybody. So that crowdsourced web application firewall is hugely valuable. Of course, they've got a great 24/7 security team watching for new vulnerabilities, deploying real-time protection. I interviewed Mark Rogers, their head of security there, on the triangulation, this guy, he's also head of security at DEF CON, which should tell you a little something. This guy knows everything. He hacked my Tesla, among other things. Not mine personally, but anyway. That's another story for another day. Of course, John Graham Cumming, their CTO, we've had him on too. Cloudflare's the best. They have the best people. They will make your site. They will make your app. They will make your SaaS faster, more reliable, more secure. And you could stop worrying about slow page loads, downtime. You could stop worrying about getting hacked. It's very easy to use. It's sign up takes less than 5 minutes. Oh, there's one more thing. I know sometimes these ads, I just like there's a list of all the things they do. If you are using a cloud provider like Amazon or Azure or Google Cloud or public or private clouds, Cloudflare not only works with all of them, but you don't get locked in because you can easily move around using Cloudflare. So you can use more than one cloud provider. This is a really great solution. Prices range from, as I mentioned, free to $20 a month, $200 a month. If you've got a big site with lots of traffic, they've got custom plans for you. I want you to go to cloudflare.com/twit because they have right now a sign up for Twit listeners only. If you go to cloudflare.com/twit, Cloudflare, CloudFlare.com/twit, you can talk to one of their top support engineers, and he can answer any question that you've got. He'll help you answer any questions. He knows more about how Cloudflare works than anybody except maybe John Graham Cumming or Mark Rogers, certainly more than me. He can help you understand what Cloudflare can do for you. And this is free and exclusive to you because you're listening to Twit. Go to cloudflare.com/twit, and you can sign up for that free online chat session. Get all your questions answered. Cloudflare.com/twit. Now back to Twit.
Thank you, Leo, and thank you to Cloudflare for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and move into the bytes. Our health data, or pretty much any data for that matter, is a pretty lucrative asset remaining today. Companies like Nokia, Apple, Google, Fitbit, Amazon, and more collect your data on a daily basis. And, you know, Google starts with the search data, Nokia with Y things on your health telemetry data. But Apple began their campaign and their Apple Watch with their Apple Watch, actually, and their health kit. And they collect your data on your phone, which they say they won't sell. And they say that even though governments ask for it, they won't give it to them. Soon there will be even more health wearables, and they'll be piping your health telemetry into the phone as well as the external services. As part of Apple's campaign, they have even gone as far as to say they won't actually sell your health data to advertisers. And Tim Cook is actually quoted saying that they don't siphon the data from your phone and then leave it secured on the device since it's your data. So here's the question, interesting thing. Why do we trust these companies so much with their data? Cheaper, this goes back to the fact that we don't necessarily care about security and privacy. Why are we trusting companies to put all of our health data, telemetry, our heart, our you know, where we walk, what we do every day, our, you know, soon to be some of these other devices, our blood sugar, all this stuff, just to be put on our phone? Why do we trust Apple with this data?
One word, convenience. For some reason or another, a lot of people don't consider, you know, oh, it's not health data. It's just my jog. It's not this or that. You know, I don't know. You know, it's one of those weird things. We yell and scream about our privacy, but yet we're telling the world exactly where we jog, GPS location, also, so subject to GPS accuracy. We're advertising, you know, into the cloud, our blood sugar levels, what drugs we're taking, lots of interesting things. There's sooner or later, the general public's going to have some wake-up calls. And we're going to start realizing just what all these little grains of sand can be put together to do. Because realistically, if, say, for instance, insurance company, a life insurance company, starts harvesting, say, drug data or blood glucose data or even jogging data, and they start putting it together with a lot of other data, and they start saying, wow, this guy is actually a prime candidate for a stroke or this or that. You know, it could start becoming something we really and truly don't want. So I'm glad this company is saying, no, they're not going to share. I'm glad Tim Cook is saying, no, we're not going to share. I'm hoping that stays that way. Because I certainly love the convenience. I don't like using paper notebooks for my blood glucose recording. I use an app. I like the fact that the app automatically gets backed up and I don't have to worry. I can record things on any of my iDevices. So this is going to be interesting. You know, I would be really interesting to actually hear us looping back on this topic just for a second with Ed, with our guest, because he's got some really interesting views about the cloud and cloud security and so forth. So,
Absolutely.
This is sounding like a topic we're going to come back to again and again.
Yeah, it's interesting enough. Statista was a company that recently took a survey of 2,200 people, and they found that which companies do we actually trust the most with our data? And in fact, Amazon actually, I think Kevin showed the graph a little bit ago. Amazon was actually top on that list with people's data. Then the next one down being your cell phone manufacturer. And that's not to be confused with the service providers, not like AT&T or so on, but the actual cell phone itself. And then obviously Google, Apple, Facebook, and Twitter. So this is interesting because, again, a lot of people saying, hey, I think it was Apple at some point because of the adoption of the iOS devices and the movement of their actual services. And we'll probably get into that a little bit of why is their services so valuable right now. But the interesting part is, what kind of messages is it sending? Like, for instance, I think somebody brought it up in the chat room. If you buy some kind of a private item on Amazon, whether it's a health item or whatnot, your purchase history and so on, it's not protected health information against under HIPAA, right? And when you do Dr. Google searches about some things that are wrong with you, that information is collected. Think of the Strava location data and, you know, Google location data and information about what you search on. I mean, these things are not protected under you know, these types of rules and regulations. So again, the question is, what kind of message do you think this is sending? If we say, hey, Amazon is the number one thing that we trust, even though we give them all the data, no matter, you know, people don't realize how private some of the data they give them and what machine learning can do around it. You know, what kind of message is this sending? What does that mean for consumers going forward? What do they have to do to start being aware?
Yeah, I don't know, but all I can say is when websites ask me to sign up for things and they ask me for my real birthday, month, day, year, I lie. I lie every single time. I am not going to give them that information.
I think at some point they crowdsource that information. I think I've done the same thing for years, but some sites just seem to get it somehow. I don't know. I don't even know. I have to change. Luckily, I use a VoIP system for my home phone, so I get to change the phone number every so often. But somehow they get that number, too. I don't know how they do that. There was actually interesting. So kind of pivot slightly. There was an interesting article done by Macworld a while back, and they talked a little bit about how can you actually secure your data better on your device. And the number one thing obviously being, let's go through a couple of them, and maybe cheaper, you have a couple extra ones here. But one thing, obviously, the iPhone does have an encryption capability. But the first thing is obviously passcodes, and make sure that are especially alphanumeric ones, because they showed a grid of how time to crack based on a, you know, a specific type of machine. And they said ones with you know, lowercase letters and numbers that's, you know, as big as 8 characters long could take over 7,000 years to actually crack. So I think if you, you know, obviously depending on the attack method, but, you know, again, this can definitely help with your, you know, securing your phone and the data on the phone. Obviously, if you're going to do messaging, I know I promise this is not an advertisement for Apple, but, you know, they say, you know, use iMessage. And why? Because iMessage is actually an encrypted platform and a protocol that they use. Of course, also use the secure enclave on the device as well. And that means like such as your Touch ID or some of the other capabilities on the phone that actually store data in the special part of the processor that stores encrypted data. Of course, turn off background data use and as well as disable any notifications on unnecessary apps. Now, again, this doesn't necessarily really save your phone if somebody gets it and wants the data off of it, but at least it prevents data from being siphoned off of it or from from applications in the background kind of pulling things out. Cheever, is there really anything else from a perspective to prevent data from getting off some of these devices?
You know, one of the things I started doing quite a while ago is I use a commercial password vault. I actually use Splash ID. And when I'm filling out the entry for each, you know, login that I have, 9 times out of 10 now, I'm letting it generate a password for me. This allows me, even with my Swiss cheese memory, to keep track of literally thousands of accounts across machines all over the world and still have some seriously nasty passwords. The ones that I have overseas have upwards of 40 characters in them, and they are very random. So good luck.
Absolutely. That's good details. I think, yeah, especially make sure you're password protecting. Make sure you're using as many characters as you can on the device or any web application that you have. Obviously, there that length and that complexity is there for a reason. Use it. Well, let's move on to the next bite. So we constantly hear about reported scenarios where cloud services and sometimes security firms can make small mistakes and leak out or lose data. And so the question is, why do we trust them so much? Well, it's been reported recently that a top security firm and purveyor of anti-malware detection services woke up to a pretty darn bad report about a massive vulnerability in their flagship product. The report came out of a leak, included data which covers a wide range of confidential data, including customer credentials, financial records, among other sensitive files. Based on research done by security firm Direct Defense, the discovery was inherently basically an inherited flaw leading into their anti-malware product offered by Carbon Black. Carbon Black is a U.S.-based company that supplies security products to nearly a third of the largest 100 public and privately held companies in the U.S. This kind of reminds me a bit of the net when Sandra Bullock was exposing gatekeeper software. But Carbon Black actually specializes in something called endpoint detection, and it's a endpoint detection and response, or EDR. And it's a term for security tools that detect and investigate suspicious activity on networked endpoints such as mobile devices and laptops and desktops. So the data collected on potential threats is aggregated into a central location in the cloud for further analysis to help grow and inform the platform's threat intelligence capabilities. Well, as Direct Defense points out, the data is actually sent up to a cloud service for scanning, and cloud-based multi-scanners often operate as for-profit business, which means companies or even governments can pay for the service, and they can access the scanners and the data on them. So this seems kind of weird because if companies are sending their data up to get scanned and other people can access it, that's almost a weird loophole in their system here. So how did Carbon Black actually respond? Well, in their blog post, Carbon Black CTO and co-founder Michael Viscuso claims that the data discovered by the researchers was available due to clients having turned on and off by default function that allows them to share files with the cloud-based multi-scanner for threat analysis. Wait a second. So it's okay that the data was leaked because to the highest bidder because the service was off by default. I don't get what he's saying there, but that's the confusing thing. So what does this lead to? This leads to the question. There's a lot of security firms out there. There's lots of startups that are coming up. They offer this level of security. Hey, use us, and we're more secure. And this is what we secure. We secure your endpoint technology. We secure your device. We secure that. But why do we trust them so much if they are more error prone to things like this? You know, what's next? I guess that's the question. Cheever, what is it about the security firms that we should be trusting? Which one should we be trusting? I guess the question would be a better question.
You know, I'm sorry. They're humans. Humans make mistakes. And if we're thinking anyone, no matter how big a corporation or how small a corporation they are, is never going to make a mistake. Have I got a deal on a bridge for you? You know, that's the bottom line. We've gone away. A lot of the attitude, let's put it that way. A lot of the attitudes about having others check your work, the whole concept of peer review has really and truly started going away. I don't know what this is. You know, we used to have a saying in the industry, trust but test. And I don't see that anymore. Why, Emily, yeah, I know there's FDIC protection, but why don't we have a more rigorous checks and balance system? I think the companies that I'm willing to trust are the ones that are willing to do a trust but verify and do peer review. A lot of people trust InfoWorld magazine because for the longest time, we could not make an article public until it was reviewed by at least two other editors in different segments. You know, you had to have a peer review. And that whole thing is a lot of people trust academics because we do peer review. Maybe security firms need to think that they need to bring peer review back into every process, not just algorithms.
Right. You know, it's interesting. Emily Strange in the chat room actually brought it up. I think she has the next great startup idea to make millions of dollars here is, you know, there needs to be maybe an insurance company of some type that offers insurance when your data is leaked, or maybe even when security firms kind of let you down. In fact, she even talks about there should be some kind of FDIC protection. You know, that's a little bit shooting for it, for saying that the government should protect it. But saying that maybe some startup, you can, you know, pay for some insurance, or maybe it comes with some of your insurance claims that you can actually get security for this types of things. So that might be an interesting take on it, maybe a new business. There's, you know, I did want to talk about some of these other companies. Like, so for instance, this past year, there's been a ton of breaches. One was called OneLogin, which is a San Francisco-based company that allows users to manage their logins and multi-sites through a cloud-based platform. They actually were breached, and I think their sign-on identity management system was breached, where there's over 2,000 companies in 44 countries and 300 apps. I think a threat actor obtained their access to their AWS keys, as well as the, you know, people can access their API by using that. I guess DocuSign, I think back in May, customers, I don't know if we didn't really talk about this, we probably should, but they were actually breached, and customer and users were targeted by a malware phishing attack. That was not very reported very widely, but that actually affected me. I was using DocuSign at the time, and I got a bunch of emails, strange emails at that. I guess question back, you know, is what else can we do here? It's to keep data safe. I think obviously Emily Strange brought up this idea, but is there really anything else other than maybe to put our trust into these systems and just say, you know, like you said, people are human. We put our trust in them. We use these password management services. We put our trust in them, saying, hey, we use one master pass. Everything else is encrypted. You know, is there really anything else that we need to be doing here that will keep our data safe?
You know, I have no magic bullets for you, dude. I keep hoping, you know, the science fiction will swing into the rescue and say, oh, we've got something so convenient that, you know, when someone tries to access your confidential information, you have some sort of automatic process that understands you, you know, Jarvis or something, saying, yes, that's cool. And, oh, by the way, Mr. Stark, I'm not sure about this. Do you want to approve this before I let it go? You know, something, I don't know, science fiction. Come on, someone dream something up and let's implement it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we do. We definitely need a Jarvis. I need a Jarvis every day, so I can tell you that. Well, folks, that does it for the Bipes. But when we come back, we have a little bit about hybrid clouds, and we want to talk a little bit about security as well. But first, we couldn't do this week at Enterprise Tech without our great sponsors. And Leo wants to tell you about a pretty great one.
Excuse me, gentlemen, if I might interrupt briefly for a word from our sponsor, as they used to say. This week in Enterprise Tech brought to you today by Amazon Web Services and a new service from Amazon they wanted you to know about called Kinesis. You know about this? In the information age, data is the new gold, right? Businesses need data, but you also need not just the raw data, you need to understand the data, and real-time data is better, and understanding real-time data is best. That's why Amazon Web Services built Amazon Kinesis. It's only AWS could do this. A powerful new way to collect, process, and analyze streaming data in real time so you can get timely insights and react quickly to new information coming in. Nowadays, you have millions of people going to the website. You've got mobile apps. You've got IoT. If you have an IoT device out there, you could be generating, you know, a colossal amount of data, a terabyte an hour, more. And if you could only capture it and process it in real time, maybe you could learn something about what your customers and your application and your products are doing right now and help you respond right away. That's what Amazon Kinesis is all about. And as always with AWS, at a very low cost, because you only pay for what you use. With just a few clicks, you could start sending data from hundreds of thousands of data sources simultaneously, loading in real time. You could process and analyze the data. You could do it raw, of course, with the Kinesis Firehose. All you need to know is SQL. So that's, you know, I mean, I bet you your engineers could easily query the Firehose, but you also have a very robust API that you can interact with Kinesis, and all the apps work with Kinesis. So you can, plug your Firehose into a variety of apps or even custom applications so you can get exactly what you need. But it starts with Kinesis and the ability to handle this Firehose of information and make sense of it. And that is awesome. You can find out more at kinesis.aws, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, kinesis.aws, K-I-N-E-S-I-S.aws. Amazing. Amazon Kinesis. Yeah, another great product from Amazon Web Services. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And now I send you back to the show.
Thanks, Leo. Well, folks, we get to my favorite part of the show, and that's we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And this time it's no exception. We have Edwin Ewan, analyst from the Enterprise Strategy Group covering system management, PaaS, and DevOps. Edwin, welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you very much.
Can you tell the folks a little bit at home what you do, what kind of work you do, and what does ESG do?
Sure. And we can probably throw the ESG slide up there. ESG is an analyst firm. So like many of the other industry firms, we go and we talk to customers and we talk to all the different vendors. We understand the different areas. We do that type of analytics and write reports on what the state of the market is. We also do a lot of research. We do this great firsthand primary research. We go and we ask this, vast kind of majority of people out there that we can reach very specific questions. And in my case, I asked them about hybrid cloud and cloud usage. And then we do a lot of strategy work for people. So it's some of this research data that's kind of very interesting to kind of understand and kind of get the pulse of, where people are and what people are doing in enterprises.
So I think recently you talked a little bit about there was a paper that you actually wrote about hybrid cloud. So if maybe you could tell the folks at home a little bit, what is hybrid cloud and why do organizations use it?
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting thing because a lot of companies, a lot of vendors and everyone in the industry is talking about hybrid cloud, and we really didn't define hybrid cloud very much. So that was one of the questions that I asked within the research that I did. What exactly would you define hybrid cloud? Because as I worked at different vendors, people argued, is it on and off premises? Is it just about the infrastructure? Is it about the application? Is it managing different vendors? And we actually have a result. I think it's slide 4, if we can put that up. We can jump to it. And what we did is I asked that question, what exactly do you define as hybrid cloud? And what we found is that the largest number of people responded saying it's about managing applications that have resources that's on and off premises. And then we got, that's about 43%, and that's in that blue section. And about 12% in that kind of orange section said it's about applications that have resources, but you're deploying them. So what we're seeing is about 55% really think it's about applications. So that's pretty strong. Only 19% said it was just about managing resources. Maybe I got a little bit of storage on, Amazon or Azure, or I've got a little bit of compute spread all over the place. And about 1/5, about 20% said it's about managing different vendors. Hybrid cloud is about managing, let's say, a VMware environment with a Microsoft environment. So the things that we found is that it's really app-related. So the majority is app-related, and it's also very strongly about on and off premises. So really, I think we can think about hybrid cloud as on and off premises, way from an app orientation. You're still managing infrastructure, but it's got that application orientation. It's not as much about disparate vendors, and I really think it's important to make a distinction between multi-cloud and hybrid cloud, because I think they can be subsets of each other, but I don't think the two definitions are the same.
Right, right, right. So I guess the interesting thing, in the research you say integration and compatibility with pre-existing on-premise systems was one of the most important attributes of hybrid cloud users. Why, I guess maybe the question for me is why must they keep their old solutions? Why not use new solutions that, you know, are secure cloud services? Is that just what's the reason behind having to kind of go this hybrid cloud route? I know you said number one reason was applications, but again, they can get new applications. So I guess what's holding them back?
I think that everybody's got a pretty big investment in what they have on premises right now. So we could set aside, you know, newer startup type companies. They've never kind of put anything together. People generally have a lot of investment already there. And it's not just an investment. It's usually pretty mature stuff. It works really well. They've got a good grip on it. They've got good management environment. And if, you know, if you ask somebody, hey, look, if you could do everything that you do in the cloud and you could do it on premises, you get the agility and the speed, maybe not the scale, but all these other things, would you want to do it, you know, on your on premises? And I think most people say, yeah, I really want to get the most of what I have now and also take advantage of the cloud. So I'm not exactly sure it's an either or type of proposition, because that's always, you know, the struggle that people portray. I think it's really an and proposition, and that's what a lot of the research had shown.
I keep hearing a lot about big changes in hybrid authentication. You know, so you have containers on premise, containers in the cloud, and things like that. And I'm just wondering, has this trend in containerization of authentication actually made a difference?
Yeah, we haven't seen that as much. I think people are still trying to figure that out. And honestly, they're really trying to figure out containerization to a great extent. And I think people are kind of, at least we're getting past that comment that, oh, you know, it's a replacement for virtual machines. I'll just put it in another way. But I think people need to kind of – the jump that we make is what I usually call the laptop jump, where everything works really well on the laptop or maybe well on the two or three computers in your systems. But for an enterprise, we need to go ahead and we're going to deploy it to thousands of systems we have. We got to think about more than just creation and more than just deployment. We have to think about ongoing operations, and those things are getting caught up. So advancing that and using authentication within is something that people are playing with. I don't know if they've reached that point where we've seen these kind of large and mass deployments. And it's not just that you need large and mass deployments. You learn from large and mass deployments, and that's where you get the experience from and then determinations on use.
So another question for me, I think, is, you know, you talk a little about AD and how security and identity, but, you know, as a IT security person out in the field, what do they need to know about hybrid clouds? What's the first thing should they be paying attention to when it comes to hybrid clouds?
I think what they really need to pay attention to is the management of it and how they can connect up and understand that. You know, I've talked to a number of different systems management vendors that provide solutions for, let's say, you know, AD management, you know, and they point out stuff like, you know, if you do it in the cloud, do you have the same capabilities? If you delete a user, can you recover it? What's the process? So what they really need to understand is that if they're going to go ahead and use cloud-based services, they need to make sure that the management and controls that they expect on-premises is going to be available off-premises. And then you kind of go ahead and take a look at, you know, the security side and the access side and the control side. But there's a kind of a very basic thing, because I think there's an expectation people have when they go and do things with either a SaaS model or any sort of public cloud model, that the service is kind of provided. And the service is provided, but realistically, it's really they're providing you the framework in order to do it. They're not providing a full implementation generally. It's up to you to still kind of manage, run, and control it. And when we start thinking about things like regulatory compliance and these other rules, we don't want to forget that the liability is still within the company itself. It's not within the public cloud provider. It's within you. It's your company since you're providing that end service. So you need to understand that kind of end-to-end.
Right. So that kind of almost segues into, you talked a little bit about compliance and so on. And with hybrid cloud, you know, you have to kind of figure out the breakdown of essentially how your data is supposed to be stored in the cloud. Like, for instance, you know, where's your business critical data go? Does it go to your private cloud? You know, less, you know, critical business data, does it go in the public cloud? You know, what are ways that businesses can think about this, and how can they can kind of control that? You know, are there easy ways to do this? Are there tools? Are there just, you know, how other companies are doing it? What's the best way to do this from a implementer standpoint?
It's really about getting a great systems management tool that can do the inventory, to do the assessment of what you have. Surprisingly, I think everybody at large enterprises have some tools, but I don't know if they really know everything about their enterprise, so to speak. I was talking to somebody today, a vendor day, and they noted that, you know, customers will tell them, hey, you know, we're using your tool for 80% of, you know, my applications or 80% of my workloads or my nodes. But I haven't gotten around to that other 20%, but that's okay because I'm worried about the 80. And realistically, what you really need to do is you need to worry about the 100%, so to speak. You actually probably worry less about those things that you use day to day, and you get a lot of visibility, and you need to understand what that other 20% is, and then understand that, you know, what the storage requirements are and what the needs are from there. So really having that base understanding of what the requirements are and what your needs are there, because then you can decide if you're going to get a placement both from an operational functionality, you know, do I get better performance? Is it access from multiple endpoints? Am I going to provide better service by putting it into the public cloud? And generally, you know, especially if it's widespread, you will. And then you've got to apply a lot of those kind of data sovereignty and other, you know, requirements, you know, with GDPR coming up in Europe and things like that. Do I need to keep it within certain countries? If I decide to go ahead and use a public or a hyperscale provider, do they have the locations that I need to keep the sovereignty there? Are they going to abide by those rules? Are they going to make sure that the stuff doesn't float around? So it's a pretty open field there, but I think what it starts with now are the base tools that really does a collection and understands not just the majority of the resources that are potentially going to be managed or moves or the storage, but really tries to get all of them.
Okay, so got to ask. People that are starting to think, okay, maybe hybrid clouds are starting to make sense for me, but we've been burned by security issues. Do you have words of wisdom other than hire ESG group? But, you know, do you have words of wisdom?
You know, what I would – the words of wisdom I have is to go ahead and actually place kind of – what I call kind of canary workloads into the public cloud and get a running and understanding. What our research actually showed is that the majority of people actually think that the most of their workloads is going to be on premises. And I think that's kind of a bit of a shocking thing for them. And I think it's slide 6 that we have, and we can throw that up there if we get a chance. What we found is that we asked people, hey, look, in 5 years, where do you think your workloads are going to be? And 42% of them said, hey, most of my workloads are still going to be on premises. And 49% said, hey, most of my, you know, I think at least half of it is going to be evenly split between off-premises and the cloud and on-premises. Only 7% said, I think everything is going to be up into the public cloud. And I think what we're finding, and those numbers are significant because that 42%, that blue box that says I'm going to keep more on-premises, what we found is the more that people use public cloud, the more they already have in public cloud, the more that they expect to have more on premises. And I think what we're finding is that you really need to use public cloud more in order to understand what should go in there and what shouldn't go in there. So it's one of these things where you don't want to shun away from it. I don't think we're in a situation where people are going to pull back or you're going to have backlash. I think what will happen is it'll balance out because we're going to put a lot in public cloud that's new and that's really cloud native and, you know, with microservices. But we also need to put, you know, other applications and workloads and then test it out. You know, what are the security requirements? What are the results? What do I expect to be able to inspect that I can't inspect now that, you know, it's in the public cloud environment? Even the vendors that make management tools and security tools, we've talked to them and they say, hey, look, we'd love to go ahead and do the same thing we give you guys on premises. The problem is that, you know, some of these APIs just aren't available. And it's not anything malicious. It's just it's not as mature. And those companies are kind of working with the providers like Amazon and Microsoft to kind of open those things up and so they can get more access. So it's all part of a process. So but I would definitely talk about this concept of more of this canary type application that you can go and test out and test it end to end from an operation rather than putting more and more workloads up and only going, you know, an inch deep, so to speak.
Is there anything else that we would like to cover that maintains the hybrid cloud? I know we covered a little bit of security and, you know, kind of the multi-cloud scenario, you know, maybe the on-premise side. Is there anything else that we should be covering from that perspective?
Well, I think the other thing is, you know, from the multi-cloud aspect, it's one of these things and that we would try to – and there's a slide that – it's actually going to be slide 2. The slide that – that we like, this, which is really interesting, when we ask people how many public cloud providers are using, and in this case, we didn't do SaaS at all, so let's set that aside. This is IaaS and PaaS. What we found is that nearly three quarters of people out there are using more than one provider. And more importantly, nearly 40%, or really over 40%, are using three or more providers. So it's not a one provider type of game. It's not even a two provider kind of game. There's lots of different providers out there. So I want people to kind of remember when they go out there and they go and they talk to their vendors or they talk about solutions when they want think about security or compliance, that they think need to think beyond just one or two providers. They need to really kind of track down and think about all the different providers they use. And some of them may be niche or some of them could be very specific to a project. But most enterprises are using a large number of public cloud providers and they really kind of need to get a grasp on it.
Right, right. Now, there's also on this slide, it talks a little bit about, integrations and how you have to pay attention to some of the other systems that you need to integrate to, because some of them might be legacy and they can only be on-premise versus being able to integrate them into a hybrid cloud. Well, you know, are there a good percentage of organizations that do have to do that type of thing, or they even know that they have to do that sort of thing?
The interesting thing is that more and more, as you do more hybrid cloud, I think what they're really realizing is they need to go ahead and integrate back from public cloud. So we talk to a lot of customers. They say, hey, look, are you primarily on premises and you're extending into the public cloud, or are you in the public cloud and you're extending back down? And three quarters were kind of infrastructure up. They're going from their infrastructure and extending into cloud. But over a quarter are in the cloud and extending back down. And I think hybrid's a two-way street. It's not just about, I'm taking my on-premises stuff and extending it into the cloud. There are things that you'll want and that you'll build native in the cloud that you'll want to scale really well. But you still want to have, some data connections or other connections back down, or even authentication connections. So that's the thing that I think most companies or most enterprises kind of really need to think about, that it's not, hybrid is not a one-way street. You're not just going from your on-premises into the cloud. There are going to be situations where you need to go ahead and take things that you've built and scaled in the public cloud and then connect it back. And that is why you kind of really need to understand how your storage works and how your network works and how your authentications work.
Right, right. Well, unfortunately, we've actually run out of time, and this has been some great information, and we do really super appreciate you coming on the show and talking a little bit about hybrid cloud. Thank you so much for coming on. Edwin, can you tell the audience a little bit at home where they can find you, where they can find your work, where they can find a little bit about ESG?
Sure. You can go to ESG at esg-global.com, and then you can also keep an eye out for my Twitter. It's at Edwin Yuen, EDWINYUEN, and you'll see some of the latest reports I've gotten, some news whenever I go to a show, probably a couple of pictures of my kids and cats. But other than that, that's a great way to follow me.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Edwin, for coming on the show. We'll definitely have to have you back. We want to talk a little bit about security and other things, especially around hybrid cloud. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour of the best dang enterprise show, according to 9 out of 10 private clouds. But, of course, we can't do this show without my co-host in crime. And I want to thank him. He's also our Tyler's producer, Mr. Brian Cheebert. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, where they can find all your work?
Well, I'm Cheebert at twit.tv. I'm also on Twitter at ADVNETLAB. You know what occurred to me with Edwin and a few other folks? If we can only figure out how to have, a few more people, we might be having a heck of a security roundtable, if you ask me.
Absolutely, yeah. Definitely have to have him back and do that for sure. Folks, I also want to thank you. You tune in each and every week. We couldn't do the show without you. And if you want to continue to have your enterprise goodness, stop what you're doing right now. Go to twit.tv/Twiet. You'll find there all of our great episodes, our back episodes, links to all of our show notes, and some pretty good topics as well. And also pay attention to that button right there. It says subscribe to videos, subscribe to audio. You can choose the type of audio and video of your choice, video, HD video, HD audio, and you can download it to your device of your choice, phone, tablet, laptop, desktop. Also, make sure you share Twiet with your friends and family. Remember also, though, if you want to subscribe, you can also show and watch the show live each and every week, Friday at 1:30 Pacific time, where you can also come to live.twit.tv and actually watch that show live. But, of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well come into the chat room and chat with the great chat room that we talk each and every week about some great topics, to get some great questions from the chat room for our guests, as well as for some good topics for our Blips and Bytes. Also, don't forget to follow me on twitter.com/LouMM, where you can find all the cool things that I'm working on, as well as, can even pitch some show opportunities there as well, and I can forward them on to Chibert. But also, don't forget to visit graph.microsoft.com and dev.microsoft.com to check out all the stuff that I'm working on. And of course, before we go, I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. I want to thank Leo and Lisa for allowing us to do this show each and every week. Great support there, as well as thank you to all the engineers at Twit that make this show possible, and of course to our tireless producer, Mr. Chibert, Mr. Brian Chi, and of course to our TD this week, Kevin, do you have a camera on yourself there yet? You guys still have cameras in that studio there?
No. I'm here.
No, we don't have any equipment in the studio.
I mean, we have this shot and this shot.
There you go.
I
okay,
never set
fantastic.
Up for myself, but yeah. I'm eating animal crackers.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Kevin. Thanks so much for your help this week. We really hope that you guys come back next week for a great episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca. And if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.